Well, the purpose of this session is to interest you in going to Israel with me in May. We'll be digging the last week of May, first week of June. We need help. So you've got a couple months to get yourself organized, and hope I'll see you there. All right. Well, this is the search for Joshua's eye. With regard to Jericho, the question there was not where is Jericho. We know where Jericho is. Nobody disputes that. The question is the dating of that destruction layer. That's the issue. And I think an in-depth analysis solves that issue. Here, the issue is, where is I? That's the big problem. Where is I? And so that's what we'll be looking at. So we have some geographical matters to consider. And so in your handout, I give you a nice big map of the area of in the vicinity of our site. And you see Elbira over on the left. Somebody was asking me, how close are we to Elbira? I guess it's a couple of kilometers there to the west. And then if you continue west, you come to Ramallah. Ramallah's in the news quite often. And that's the seat of the Palestinian Authority. Gaza, of course, was taken over by Hamas over on the coast, so they had to get out of Gaza. Now they're at Ramallah. And, of course, what's his face that died a few years ago? Yasser Arafat. He ruled from Ramallah. In fact, there's a nice, I shouldn't say nice, there's a big memorial to Yasser Arafat in, I think it's actually in Elbira. Well, anyway, this is the area. We're about 9 miles north of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's off the map to the south. The Jerusalem airport runway is visible down there in the lower left corner. The traditional site of Ai is at Tel, that you see just 1 kilometer to the east of Kerbet El Makadr. The location of Ai, actually, it goes back to the very beginnings of research in the area of Palestine. The first major scholar to work in this area was Robinson, kind of an explorer, and he was trying to locate biblical places. And when he came to the little village of Beitin, that you'll see there just northwest of Kerbet El Makadr, he saw a resemblance between the modern Arabic name and the name Bethel. And so he identified Beitin as Bethel. Now, another piece of information he had was that Eusebius, the early church historian and geographer, stated that Bethel was 12 Roman miles north of Jerusalem. Well, Robinson happened to be on horseback, the mode of transportation of the day in 1838, and he had a very neat way of measuring distances. He had kind of figured out how fast his horse was traveling. And so he would keep track of the time it would take to go from point A to point B, and knowing that the horse went, I don't know what the figure was, 4 miles an hour or whatever it was, he would figure out the distance. And that's what he did for Beitin. He measured the time it took his horse to go from Beitin back into Jerusalem. And based on that, he says, it's 12 Roman miles, right on the money. This has to be Bethel. Well, we have more sophisticated techniques today. But scholars had not yet recognized that. They're still going by Robinson's findings. Yet today, Beitin is not Bethel. Bethel should be located at Elbira. We won't go into a big discussion about this. But that was the kind of the jumping off point for locating Ai, because we're told in the Bible in several places that Ai is east of Bethel, or Bethel is west of Ai. And so scholars said, well, now that we know where Bethel is, all we have to do is go east and kind of check all those sites, and we will find Ai. And that was done. All of these places that I show here have been checked out in one way or another, not necessarily by excavation, maybe surface survey or something. And they came to the conclusion that the only place that could possibly be Ai is Et Tel. And Albright, our good friend W.F. Albright, published an article in 1923, I think it was, putting this forward. And he's made very strong statements such as, I have scoured every hill and every site west of 18, east of 18, and there's absolutely no other possibility than Et Tel. Et Tel must be Ai. And so that was Albright's conclusion. Of course, everybody lines up behind Albright like a bunch of little ducks, you know, and they follow him. And if Albright says it's so, it must be so. And so that's how Et Tel came to be identified as Joshua's Ai. Now, there's just one little problem with that identification. You know, teeny tiny, small problem, and that is that nobody was living there at the time of Joshua, at the time of the conquest. Massive city from the early Bronze period, nothing from Middle Bronze, nothing from Late Bronze. Then about 1100, we have a small Iron Age village there, probably Israelite. And so there's this huge occupation gap. And some try to get around that by saying, well, if they dig some more, they'll find Late Bronze. No, it's not there. There isn't any. It's not Ai. That's the reason why. It simply does not fit the biblical description. That's the major point, but there's other points as well. And I go through those in an article. Is it on your references here? 2008, The Search for Joshua's Ai. I go into a lot of detail about the location of Bethel and why Et Tel can't be Ai and so on and so forth. So our little site is just 1 kilometer to the west of Et Tel, in the same vicinity. Obviously, Ai has to be somewhere in this vicinity. And our research shows that Bethel should be located at El Bira, and our site is nicely to the east of El Bira. Unfortunately, as you see, El Bira is a modern Palestinian town, so kind of difficult to excavate there, but I'm hoping we might be able to do a little bit of work at the high place called Raset Tahuna, just a little north of the dot with El Bira next to it. This seems to be the high place of Bethel. Of course, that's one of the main indicators that you found Bethel, is that you find a major religious center there, like we have at Dan up in the north. And some of you have been at Dan. You know what it looks like, the big altar and all this structure around there and buildings and cultic material. What did they find at Beitin? Zippo. A couple little crummy farmsteads from the Iron Age II period. Not one single piece of cultic material from the Iron II period has come out of Beitin, or any period. No cultic material whatsoever. Absolutely no sign that there was ever a cultic center there. And we know there must have been a very big, important cultic center at Bethel in the Iron Age II period, the divided monarchy. We're right at the border between the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, right in this area. And so this would be a major big statement by the Northern Kingdom for people, you know, crossing from one side over to the other. Well, anyway, I'm kind of getting off the subject here, but you can see right away we meet that geographical requirement. And while we're looking at the map, notice Wadi Shaban, very deep wadi, between our site and Bethel, El Bira. And we read in the account in Joshua chapter 8 how Joshua placed an ambush force between Bethel and Ai. And this is the perfect location because you cannot see into that valley either from our site. There's a little kind of a ridge between our site and that valley, or from El Bira, Bethel, because there's some hills between El Bira and that very deep valley. So here, right away, we see, geographically speaking, our site is meeting the biblical requirements very nicely. Well, let's get into the picture, and into the pictures, we'll talk a little bit more about this. Here is a reconstruction by Lane Rittenmeyer, the foremost archaeological surveyor and drawer of such things, of our gateway that we found on the northern side of our site. This is my article. I don't know why I put this in there, but that's goes into a lot of detail about locating Ai and the requirements in the Bible and so on and so forth. After Jericho, then, we're told the Israelites went up into the hill country and attacked Ai. And after the initial defeat because of the sin of Achan, they came back a second time, and they were successful with the Lord's help. Well, here's what Albright has to say. This is sometime after his initial article saying that et tel is I. Since the writer has scoured the district in question in all directions, now the district in question would be, of course, around Beitin, which he thought was Bethel, hunting for ancient sites, he can attest the fact that there is no other possible candidate for I than et tel. Well, that's pretty definitive, isn't it? I mean, who's going to question that? I am. Joe Calloway, there's no late bronze evidence in the region east of Bethel, he's thinking Beitin, that I can find. Here's Amahai Mazar. I love the arrogance of these guys. I mean, they just know for a fact there's no evidence of a second millennium Canaanite city at this spot, et tel, or at any other site in the region. This constitutes unequivocal archaeological evidence for the lack of correlation between the story in Joshua 8, with all its topographic details, and a historical reality. Put that in your pipe and smoke it, you Baptist. Well, he doesn't know his facts. Here's Edward Robinson, the guy who got us off on the wrong foot. To this ruin, Kerbert L. McCotter, he visited our site May 5th, 1838. One of the Greek priests at Tybe, a little to the north of our site, has chosen to give the name of Ai. And we found the same thing among some of the people of that village. Now, this is before the scholars got in there and indoctrinated everybody that et tel is Ai and Beitin is Bethel. This was before the people knew, you know, nobody told them anything. They were just going by their traditions, local tradition. The Greek priest at Tybe said, Makater is I. The people of the village say, Makater is I. And then he goes on to say, but there's not the slightest ground for any such hypothesis. There never was anything here but a church. Well, we do have a very nice Byzantine church at our site, and that's the only thing Robinson visited. He didn't go down the southeast slope of the site where the fortress was from the late Bronze I period and a later fortress from the first century B.C. So if he'd have gone just a couple hundred meters to the southeast, he might have had a totally different opinion, but he didn't, and so we're stuck with this and his identification of Beitin as Bethel. Well, here's Ernest Sellen, a German scholar who visited Makater in 1899. He said the women of Ramallah who were searching for snails call it Kerbert Ai. Well, that's interesting. And so we have a local tradition. There's no similar tradition with regard to et tel. Of course, if you go there now, all the local people, oh, there's Ai, you know. Well, here's our topographical requirements. It must be strategically important. Our site is very important. It's at the border between the Jerusalem city-state area and the Shechem city-state area. must be near Beth Aven. I believe Beitin is Beth Aven. It fits all the biblical requirements. And so we have a lot of errors that are in the literature that everybody believes that we have to deal with. First, we got to move Bethel from Beitin to Elbira. We got to re-identify Beitin as Beth Aven, and we got to forget about Et-Tel as being I. It's Et-Makater. But I will say that in Abraham's day, we have the mention of I. Again, you know, Abraham built the altar and camped on a hill between Bethel and I. I believe the I of Abraham was Et-Tel. That was a massive ruin in his day. It would have been an important landmark in a way he could mark his location. There was really, in the early Bronze Age, the time of Abraham, there was nothing at our site. It was just a little hill. So I think Et-Tel is Abraham's eye. If you want to have an eye there, I think that's the right one. Okay, east of and near Bethel. And as I say, I believe that's Elbira. An ambush site between Bethel and I. We've already seen that in the Wadi Shaban. Militarily significant hill to the north. You can look at your map and you see Jebel Abel Amar. This is the highest hill in the whole region. The Bible tells us in Joshua 8, verse 11, that when Joshua came up with the whole army, he set up his headquarters, the military headquarters, on a hill north of Ai. So this would be the perfect place. You can see the whole battlefield. You can see our site. You can see Elbira and everything. And his generals could kind of run the whole operation from up there. Shallow valley to the north. Well, why do I say that? Well, because you remember Joshua, being the clever fellow that he was, when he came to Ai in this heavily fortified place, he says, well, God brought the walls down at Jericho. I wonder what he's going to do here. I wonder if I could get the guys inside to come outside. When we sent that first contingent up here, they did just that. When our guys came against the gate, and we found a lot of sling stones at our gate, probably some of them from the Israelites. When our guys stormed the gate, the men of Ai came out and chased them all the way down the slopes, all the way down almost to Jericho. I think I could get them to come out again. So what does Joshua do? He camps. Takes a small force of men. He camps in front of Ai, on the north side of Ai. Well, that's interesting. In front of Ai? Where's that? Well, that's where the gate is. That's your front door. That's the front of Ai. The front door, the gate, is on the north side. So that's an archaeological requirement. We'll get to that in a minute. But he camped in this valley on the north side of Ai, and when the king of Ai got up in the morning and he looks out from his very strong fortress, and he looks to the north, and what does he see? He sees Joshua and those guys out there. Well, that means the valley was very shallow, because he could see them right there. They weren't hidden from view at all. And, of course, that's what Joshua wanted. And, of course, Joshua drew the men out of the fortress to pursue Ai just as the first time. I think the king even said that. He chased them away just like he did before. So Joshua draws the men of Ai out. And of course, the men in the ambush, the Israelites, come up, capture the city, set a fire, just an initial signal fire, I think, to alert Joshua. There's the smoke. They've captured the city. And then Joshua turns. The ambush guys come out. There might have been a second ambush. I know it's a little complicated. Read Peter Briggs' article on the military tactics here. But anyway, the men of Ai were caught in a pincers movement between Joshua's force and the ambush force, and they got wiped out in a kind of an area overlooking the Jordan Valley, overlooking the wilderness. Well, anyway, that's why we need a shallow valley to the north. Incidentally, at Et-Tel, the valley is, I mean, it's so deep you can't see anywhere near the bottom of that thing. It's a big, big, deep valley. Okay. Now, another thing that is strategic about our site is, on a clear day, you can see all the way to Jerusalem. This is the view from our site looking south. And there you see the Mount of Olives on the left, a couple hotel buildings there on the right, some more way over to the extreme right. But this is New Jerusalem over here, Old City over in this area. And so 9 miles away, doesn't look like 9 miles, but that's 9 miles. It happened to be one beautiful clear day when we got this picture. Usually it's very, very hazy because of all the smog from Jerusalem, of course. So from Makkadr, you have line of sight communication with Jerusalem. And I believe that's the purpose of this fortress here on the edge of the Wadi Gaya, which is shown there on your map. That was the border between the Jerusalem city-state to the south and the Shechem city-state to the north. And so the fortress would warn Jerusalem if there were any attacks coming from the north. They could quickly warn Jerusalem, and they could prepare for the coming battle, whoever that might be. So it's strategically located, and here is in beautiful color the map that you have in your handout. So we've talked about this already, so we'll just move on from here. And there's our Beitin being Beth Avon, El Bira over there to the west. And so it's, it meets all of the geographical requirements. Now here's an aerial view looking northwest, and you can see the modern town of Deir Dabuan here. Incidentally, Deir means monastery, and it's probably named after the monastery at our site. Here's Et Tel. Does not meet more than a couple of the geographic requirements, and of course, archaeologically, it simply doesn't meet it at all because there was nothing there at the time of Joshua. And here's our site, Kibrut el-Makkadr, and you can see several have asked about the Palestinians. Here's all Palestinian homes, some over on this side as well, all around our site. But our site happens to be in what's called Area C, which is under total control of the Israelis. And the Palestinians are not allowed to build in Area C, so we have to work through the Israelis, get their permission. They run the show in Area C, and so they issue the permit, allow us to dig there, and the local people, they don't have much say in it. Actually, the land is all owned by local Palestinians, but they're very nice folks, and we haven't had any trouble whatsoever. In fact, we've had nothing but cooperation from the local Palestinians. They've been a huge, huge help to us. So anyway, that's kind of the situation as it appears today. Nothing like it would have been in Joshua's time. Of course, this was a very, very isolated area. So there would have been a lone fortress sitting here, and the Wadi al-Gaya is coming around like this. And it's very shallow here, but it gets deeper and deeper and deeper as you continue to the east, and it eventually goes down to the Jordan Valley. It's probably the route the Israelites took when they came up, fled back, came up a second time, and of course went back to Gilgal. Here's our Wadi Shaban, and we're looking south now, and you can see our site over there to the left, and Bethel is off to the right. Just a perfect ambush location, as we read about in Joshua chapter 8. And here we're looking to the north toward that Jebel Abu Ammar. That is the highest point in the entire region. It would be an excellent place for Joshua to place his main army and his commanding generals. I've been up there a couple of times, not a lot up there, but there is one very interesting thing up there. There is a wall that goes all the way along this ridge, and there's really no explanation for it. And maybe it's something the Israelites threw up there. I don't know. But otherwise, there's nothing there. No occupation at all. So here we see the shallow valley where Joshua was with a small contingent of men. And that night, Joshua went into the valley. When the king of Ai saw that, he saw this, he and all the men of the city hurried out early in the morning to meet Israel in battle. And here it tells that they set up camp north of Ai with a valley between them and the city. That would have been up on the hill. And Joshua approached the city and arrived in front of it. And that would be where the gate was. And we're told also that it was north of the city. Well, the archaeological requirements. So we're building up quite a list here from the Bible that the candidate for I must meet. We've got all those geographical requirements. We're told in Joshua 10:2, Ai was smaller than Gibeon. Gibeon, not a big place, maybe 10 acres at the time of Joshua. Fortified, of course. There's mention of the gate, so it had to be fortified. It was on the north side, Joshua 11:8, destroyed by fire. We read Joshua 8:28 that Joshua burned the city and made it a tel olam, a ruin forever. And when you go there today, you say, wow, what a ruin. There was some occupation, but only had portions of the site and short-lived. The monastery, it's up on top of the hill, doesn't really interfere with the fortress at all. But we do have this, we have some squatter occupation, Iron Age 1, about 1100 B.C. And then we have a second fortress built in the first century B.C. It was built over the east half of the Late Bronze I fortress, and that only lasted till maybe A.D. 70, A.D. 100, something like that. Joshua 8:28, left in ruins after the destruction, Tel Olam. Here we're looking down on the site from Google, and gives you a little idea of the buildings around the site and the main road. I've talked to some of you about how do you get there. This is actually in the West Bank. This is all West Bank, actually. But here's a highway that the Israelis built in about 96 or 7, late 90s, the purpose of which is to provide an evacuation route for all the settlers on the West Bank. It connects to all the Israeli settlements that are all over the place on the West Bank. And so it's a quick way to get out and back to Jerusalem. And so we can take that security road. We can drive it right up to about here or so. Then we get off the bus. The army won't let us take the bus onto the West Bank. And we'll climb up the hill and do our digging for the day. Now, it doesn't show here, but right up at this intersection, there's an Israeli military outpost. We also have some new neighbors they're right in here, a new settlement. They're just in, they call them caravans, you know, trailers. And we have some neighbors, but we have a military presence. We have our own guards, so it's very, very secure and safe to work at the site. Another aerial view of our site. We're looking west-northwest. This is the Hasmonean fortress here, quite a massive ruin, actually. This is a wall, northern wall, as part of that Hasmonean fortress. Our gate is over here. Our north wall is over here. Everything on this side has been demolished by the Hasmoneans, unfortunately. Church and monastery up on top of the hill up there. We actually have work going on in all three areas. Here's our LB1 fortress. And we found the first socket stone right here in the first year we were there, 1995. It was right on the surface. And in subsequent seasons, we have excavated the west half of the gate, east half gone. The Hasmoneans robbed that out for their construction work. You see, they have a massive wall here. It's 5 meters wide. Now, this is our wall here, the north wall of the LB1 fortress, 4 meters wide, comes around to the west. We've got a nice section of it here. This enclosure was constructed in between our 1999 and 2000 seasons, unfortunately. In our 1999 season, we excavated in these squares here. We found part of a tower, circular tower of some kind, but we could only dig that one segment, and a little bit in front of it where we came down on top of what appears to be the southern fortification wall. It's about 40 meters wide, but it was, of course, the last day of the season, you know. And then the next season we come back all excited to continue digging there, and here it's behind this big wall and barbed wire and everything. This is an agricultural area now for one of the people, one of the landowners of the property there. Actually, that's illegal. The Israelis don't like them to do that, but they did it over some weekend, and by the time the Israelis found it, oh my goodness, too late now. And the Israelis, they don't want to cause any trouble any more than they have to, so they just let it go, and it's there, and it's, you can see, it's enclosing the north, southwest corner of our site. And I'd sure like to get in there and do some more digging, but I don't know if we will be able to or not. But on the east side, just conjecture, just kind of figuring from what's over here, what might be over here. But we really haven't found any ruins. We've looked and looked and looked, can't find anything of the eastern wall. It appears to have been totally robbed out. Well, here's some neat pottery from just inside of our gate. And some of this comes from the surface of a flagstone pavement, these pieces here. And these pieces were in the clay bedding of that flagstone pavement. So here we have some very nice cooking pots, LB1 in style, pithos, storage jars, typical LB1 types of vessels. And we have lots more of that same kind found within the walls and all over the site. Here's our west chamber of the gate. Here's the first socket stone we found. These are lower socket stones. This is the first one. This is the second one we found. And then we found an upper socket stone right here, which is a very rare find. The lower ones, of course, is where the gate pivoted. And then the upper one was provided a pivot point for the top of the gate. And this one appears to have fallen just from its original location. These may have been moved. It's hard to say. It looks like this one maybe should be up a little more up there. But anyway, no question but what their gate socket stones are very massive, very, very large. Here's a photo taken with the discoverer of the first gate socket stone, Gary Byers. And you can see that's 1995. And I walked by that. We were there, 2 weeks? No, 1 week that first season. I walked by it every morning. Didn't pay any attention because you see things like that a lot where they would hollow out a piece of the bedrock and make a place to put their water jar, while they're working out in the fields. Yeah, I paid no attention. But Inquisitive Gary had to really reach down and feel it. He says, wow, this is smooth, and dug out the dirt and went way down this, big hole, dug out of that piece of limestone. Looks like bedrock, but of course it turned out to be a, separate piece, separate block. And he shouted out, it's a gate socket stone. Oh my goodness, we couldn't believe it because, of course, the gate figures very prominently in Joshua 7 and 8. It's been safely removed now and is in storage with the Antiquities Authority. Here it is after it was excavated. And here's the upper socket stone here, right at the end of that south pier of the gate. And then we also, that's the upper socket stone. It has a hole in it. I suppose some kind of a pin went up through that and kind of kept the gate kind of opening and closing the way it should. And then, I went the wrong way. And then we have a second gate socket stone found close to the gate. Now, here's a view looking west. There's our west chamber of the gate. And here are some later installations built during that Tasmanian, early Roman period, kind of in that gate passageway. But we just, this is 2009, we dug down to bedrock in the gate passageway. And you can see how the stones are discolored. They're all reddened. And we had even some testing work done on some of the stones from the gate, and the tests indicated those stones had been subjected to very high temperatures. And so here we have clear evidence for the burning that took place in the gateway. And as we dig in the squares around that gateway, we find when we get to bedrock in many areas, the heat was so intense that it's calcined the bedrock. It's turned to a chalky, whitish, almost like lime consistency. And so there's evidence all over the site of the burning by the Israelites. And one of the strongest indications of burning by fire is kind of esoteric, I guess you'd say. Only an archaeologist would appreciate it. We started finding in the year 2000, some of the late Bronze I pottery was very, very hard. Byzantine pottery is fired very hard. And we found that this LB1 pottery was like the Byzantine pottery. It was like cement almost. Well, we finally came to the conclusion it had been refired. It had been in a very intense fire, which made it even harder than would normally be the case just from normal pottery fired in a kiln. So now we're looking for this refired pottery. We're finding it everywhere. So that's, again, evidence that the site was destroyed by fire, and we have pottery that even attests to that fact. Here's a view northwest up toward the western part of the site. And we read, as I mentioned, Joshua 28, the Israelites' burned eye made it a tel olam, a ruin forever. And when you go to the site, you just see stones all over the place, ruins, really nothing there today except some bits and pieces and remnants. That's what we're dealing with, remnants that are left behind. The site has been worked by plowing and, you know, agriculture and so on. Now, one of the interesting things we discovered was in the 2009 season, I've been working in this area because there was some kind of a building complex there just inside the gate. And we find just the foundation of these walls right down sitting on bedrock. We read in Scripture of the importance of the gate, kind of a central place of business and political activity and so on. And many times important buildings were built just inside the gate. We read, of course, about the king of Ai, who was one of these kinglets, these petty chieftains. Or here we go again. Sorry, folks, I don't know what's going on. So he must have had a place to live, a residence there, a palace. Probably not a palace, but at least a house to live in. And so I'm thinking, well, maybe it's here inside the gate. So I've been poking around there. And what I'm really looking for is the archive of Ai, of all the clay tablets, you know, the correspondence between this border outpost and other military installations between them and Jerusalem and so on. Haven't found any yet, but never say die. You know, just keep trying. But in 2009, we found this infant jar barrel right next to one of these walls. Well, that's quite significant because, number one, it tells us that there were women at the site. And the Bible refers to the elephs of men, eleph being the word that's usually translated 1,000. I would suggest it should be translated something different. Military unit is my choice. But it even includes women in those that were killed when Joshua and his troops defeated the men of Ai outside the city. And here's proof that there were, excuse me, there were indeed women there because the bones of this deceased were right around the age of birth, maybe a little before or just a little after. Here's the jar burial as it appeared when we came down to it. And we have a dipper juglet there. These are offerings, grave goods, a piriform juglet, just the tip, the bottom, and just the rim, but enough to know it was a piriform juglet, a very common item to be placed with these infant jar burials. A small cooking pot, that's very rare and unusual. I know of no other instance where such a thing was used as an offering. And then a pedestal vase, again, this is the only instance I know of that one was used for a burial. Well, when we excavated the jar, we discovered nothing. Nothing inside the jar. You see how they had cut away a hole in the bottom of the jar to place the remains of the infant inside the jar. This, again, is somewhat unusual, not totally unknown, but the more common practice was to cut off the neck of the jar and place the remains in from the top of the jar rather than the bottom. Well, I'm glad they left this with the rim, because we can date that rim type to the late Bronze I period. The other vessels, end of Middle Bronze. So it's a little strange. I don't know if these were heirlooms, antiques or what. And in three of the cases, the jars were unfired. The only one that had been fired was the dipper juglet. And so these were not things that they were using. They were scrap pieces or something. I don't know. Now, we didn't find anything in the jar, but thanks to my very careful excavators, they saved every bone that was found in the vicinity of that jar. And it turns out that we have all of these from what's called a neonate, a newborn. And so we have pretty good assemblage there, no skull. There are a lot of other bones. I didn't know one from another. They look like chicken bones to me. But when we took them to an anthropologist at the Hebrew University, neonate, she was able to, age them to around the time of birth. So that was exciting. So that was our big find in 2009. We also found down at the southern end of the site a large stone stela, matzabah, standing stone. Haven't quite figured out exactly what it is, but clearly there's a little raised area here, and there's something kind of carved there. I just don't know what it is. One of our square supervisors wrote an article on it, and he claims he sees the head of a man. Well, I'm not so sure about that. It might have had some kind of significance. It's broken here, and who knows what was on the other side. I don't know. But I'm sure it had some meaning to the people in that fortress in the late Bronze I period, some kind of religious importance, probably. Down at the southern end, not too far from that tower that we had dug in 1999, and maybe it was near a second gate, I don't know. We have this cult stand also found near the northern gate, and so there was some kind of cultic activity there, who knows what. Now here's our west wall. We're looking south here in this instance. Behind here you see the wall or the fence from the agricultural installation. So we can't go beyond that point. That's all fenced in over there. But here we have our west wall here, just coming up. And another view to the west. Now, this is quite interesting because here's the LB1 wall up here. Almost 4 meters wide, 3.85 or something. And then the Hasmoneans, they came along and they added this massive bit here with its own retaining wall here. That's about 5 meters wide. So they were doing something here on the west side of the site, some kind of an outwork or something, because we have that other wall that runs right next to the west part of our LB1 gate. That seemed to have been the main west wall of their fortress, but there's something else going on here. Here you can see the cross section, our LB1 section, and then something added on in the first century BC. And then what's nice about digging in here is that there's a lot of LB1 pottery that was scooped up when they built this addition, and all of it has been refired, and it's all whitish and it just is really like cement. It is so hard. I mentioned to somebody here, I was asked, are there any scholars who would agree with me that this is I? Well, my answer was none that will admit to it. But Shimon Gibson, a well-known archaeologist living in Israel, has been out to our site several times. He's looked at this refired pottery, and he said there's no question but what this place was burned in a severe fire. So he's seen the evidence, he's seen the gate, he's seen the walls, but so far he hasn't said to me, I think it's I, but he must be thinking along those lines because the evidence certainly does fit what the Bible tells us. Well, in 2010, we found this really nice face of a wall down in the kind of the southern eastern part of the fortress, especially this massive wall here. And we were all excited. We thought, well, maybe here's some more of the city wall. But when we went back, it turned out to be a little kind of a terrace wall, probably Byzantine in date. So that didn't help us much. So anyway, here's our crew from 2009. I haven't updated this. Shame on me. But I hope you can join us, become part of the crew. Here's 2010. And help us to dig up the evidence that Kerbet el-Makadr is the eye of Joshua et Tel. Cannot possibly be I. It just does not fit the biblical requirements, but our site fits all of the archaeological and all of the geographical requirements to be identified as the eye of Joshua. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, you want some questions?
We're going to have some pizza in a few minutes, but we've got time for questions. Any questions?
Well, the number of soldiers is a question. Because, as I mentioned, we can't go by the thousands, tens of thousands that we read in our English translation. There's a problem there with the Hebrew word aleph, and an aleph, I believe, was a military unit. The size of the unit, we simply have no idea. It seems to originate from the clan structure of ancient Israel. Many times in the Old Testament, aleph is used for a subunit of the tribe, the clan, and so on. And it seems, at least this is the theory, that subunit of a tribe was responsible for providing for a military contingent in time of war. So it just depends on how many able-bodied men were available. You know, it could be 6, maybe it could be 20, or who knows, you know. Peter Briggs, in his military analysis of Joshua 7 and 8, suggests 100 for the measurement. You know, that's kind of a guess, but you get some reasonable figures using that. The size of our site is maybe 3 acres or so, maybe even a little less, 2.5, maybe more. We just don't know where the east side goes, you know. So somewhere around 3 acres in size. So the significant thing for me is that it's smaller than Gibeon. It's maybe a third of the size of Gibeon, which the Bible says I was smaller than Gibeon. When you go over to Et Tel, it's a massive place. It's like 29 acres in size. Of course, that's the early bronze ruins. Certainly, the Iron Age I material could not. Well, I guess Calloway tried to make the Iron Age I the Eye of Joshua. But then you got to change the whole dating, you know, got to bring the conquest down to 1100 or something. It gets pretty crazy. But, you know, the ruins that are at Eye, of course, the thinking is the story was written up concerning these massive ruins in etiology. You know, hundreds of years later, somebody came along and said, oh, look at those ruins. I wonder how that came to be a ruin. I think I'll write a story about it. I'll write that the Israelites came and destroyed it, you know. So that's the thinking. Well, the writer wasn't too clever, because the ruins are much too big to fit what's recorded, you know, in the book of Joshua. So our site is much better size-wise to be identified as high. Yeah. No, the place has been so plundered and plowed up and robbed out. We did find in 2010 the base of a spear point, bronze. It's the only piece of weaponry we have found, except what we find in great abundance are sling stones about the size of a tennis ball. And this was the long-range artillery of antiquity, especially around the gate, scores of them. And we've got maybe 200, I don't know. We have just every year we find more and more and more. So again, this is indication this was a military installation. That's the only weaponry that has survived. Now, the other clue that tells us this was a military fortress is that we found find huge numbers of storage vessels, large pithoi, large storage jars, small storage jars, just in huge abundance, just everywhere. And that's because, of course, they had to provision this fortress. And that's why I'm doing neutron activation analysis, find out where these jars are coming from, hopefully from Jerusalem or somewhere down in that area. But there's just many, many jars indicating, you know, they had that place well supplied with grain and olive oil, whatever all they would need to survive out here in this really a wilderness area, the boondocks, except Bethel. There was probably a small town at the site of Elbira, but from archaeology we can't say exactly what was there. But since it's mentioned in Joshua, there was something there. Yeah. Yes. In other words, what has been found that disproves the Bible?
what has been found that just causes you to have to do a lot more research into it, because they seem to have a strong case?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I never did doubt the Bible. So every time I get to a problem, I say, well, you know, there's something wrong with the archaeology here. So, you know, I'm never intimidated, you know, because I find out once you delve into something that got people involved, the scholars involved, are doing very poor work. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't use sound reasoning or good logic. I don't know if you were here for the introduction at the beginning, but I started out my career in engineering and in the science field. Now, the other people in this field of biblical archaeology, biblical studies, they have no science training whatsoever. And it really shows in their work. They come into the field through the humanities. I come into it through science. And in my years as an engineer, I was always involved with the collection, analysis, and publication of data and what that data tells us. So I bring the same approach to archaeology. I look at the data. I gather together all the evidence, and I said, what does the evidence say? And then present my conclusions. They're always in agreement with the Bible. You know, this concept is totally foreign with archaeologists. They just get a little piece of information, and they run with it with a theory. They don't sit down, get all the evidence together. In fact, they almost discount evidence. They go more by the say-so of some well-known, famous archaeologist, or majority opinion, or what my professor taught me in college. That holds more weight, I'm sorry to say, than evidence. I mean, I present all this pottery, I present all this stuff, and they sort of laugh at it. Well, who are you? You're not Albright. You're not Kenyon. You're not Yigal Yadin. And they scoff at it. I mean, this is very bad science, and this is our problem in this field of biblical archaeology, and in fact, in biblical studies in general. That's the way it is. Yes? We're not sure. We have found no evidence on the site for any water source. In those Hasmonean ruins, there's a lot of cisterns that were dug. Some of them might go back to the time of our fortress. We have no way of dating them. We keep looking for a tunnel that leads to a spring or something, but so far nothing. There are springs, you know, around the site, not too far away, and they could fill cisterns from those springs. But you would think they would want to put their fortress right where there's a water supply. So far, no. Now, that brings up another question. Why didn't they build the fortress up on top of the hill? That's where the Byzantine monastery is. And that's where we started our digging, up there, and found nothing but Byzantine until we kind of came down the hillside and one of the members of our first year team there started picking up pottery. He says, oh, this is Middle Bronze pottery. There's some early stuff down here. And that's when we found the socket stone and found an early wall. But anyway, the only reason I can think of is there was a water supply down on this southeast slope, but we haven't found it. The Hasmoneans built their fortress there too. I'm not sure. We still have a lot of questions about the site. Anything else? I guess they're getting hungry. They've had enough archaeology. Well, you know, you could use fire signals. You could reflect, you know, the sun. I don't know too much about it, but I think there was ways. And, of course, they would have messengers. They had writing, of course, and they would have had their cuneiform tablets, I would think, to send messages back and forth. But the fact that, you know, you could set a fire and they could quickly see, you know, there's three fires in a row. That means everything's okay or whatever. Yeah, it is now. Yeah, yeah. So then you send the runner, you know, go 9 miles, make it in, you know, an hour or whatever. Yes. It's built right on bedrock. Yeah, yeah. We've gone right to bedrock in several locations. Nothing there, unfortunately. Okay, yeah, the Hasmonean. That's the intertestamental period. And this was part of the Maccabean revolt that took place, and we got the books of Maccabees in the, you know, the apocryphal writings. Kind of an interesting period. And there was a time when, the area was under, for a while, under the jurisdiction of Egypt. After the death of Alexander the Great, the empire got kind of divided up amongst these different leaders. And so Egypt had it for a while, but then the Syrians came down and they took it from Egypt. And so the Israelites there, the Jewish people, were under the control of Syria. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, you know, probably the guy talked about in Daniel desecrating the altar and all of that. But there was a time period where the Jews were actually able to throw off the Syrian yoke and become independent. And we had these rulers called the Hasmonean rulers. Hasmon comes from the family name, I think. And so they struck their own coins and so on. They cleansed the temple. Hanukkah celebrates that. And so this was the first century B.C. up until the Romans took over in 63 B.C., and so there was a period there where they had, you know, some independence, and it's referred to as the Hasmonean period. Yeah. Well, at our site, unfortunately, we don't have stratigraphy, nice layers one upon another. At other sites, you do, and that does help you to distinguish, oh, okay, this comes after something we found down here, and this is before something we found up here. Pottery typology has been worked out over the years by comparing the pottery with known dated material, usually some Egyptian type of a thing that can be dated. W.F. Albright kind of worked out the system that we use today, and we've been just refining it since his day. For the Bronze Age, we are dependent upon Egyptian chronology to establish our dates. For for the Iron Age, we're dependent upon Assyrian chronology. And for the Iron Age, our dates are better known because the Assyrian chronology is very exact and precise. Egyptian chronology, there's a little, unknown factor. Some people, in fact, are trying to move it by hundreds of years. I don't think you can do that. Maybe a decade or two, but not too much. So we sometimes find, as I showed from Jericho, these scarabs that have a cartouche of a pharaoh. Well, we know the dates of the pharaoh. So you look at the pottery like Garstang did. Oh, I find this pottery here in association with these scarabs. So I know that's 15th century B.C. pottery. And so by, doing this at multiple sites over multiple years, we've worked out a fairly decent chronology. It's subject to some plus or minus, but that painted pottery I showed you, that's pretty solid, 1450 to 1400. Some other types, not so solid, because that same style might continue. But the basic idea is that pottery is kind of like automobiles. Every year they want to come out with a new style or something that's a little different. So it tends to change through time, the shape and the style and even decoration, sometimes no decoration, sometimes simple, sometimes elaborate, And so you look for these kinds of clues, and it helps us to at least put us in middle bronze or early bronze or Iron Age, And then sometimes you can narrow it down to the century or even half century. We have been involved with the Temple Mount Sifting Project, which is not an excavation, but the sifting of debris that the Palestinians removed from the Temple Mount, and they dumped it in the Kidron Valley. And so Gabriel Barkai, Israeli archaeologist, decided, hey, this stuff is probably full of all kinds of good archaeological material. So he got permission to sift that big pile of dirt. Paula Owens can tell you firsthand back here. She participated one year with one of our groups. So they're sifting through that and finding all kinds of neat stuff, coins and pottery, of course, and some written material and just all kinds of stuff. So that's neat. And we had a dig prior to my dig. We worked at Kerbet Nisya, which is in the area. It's on your map here over close to El Bira. Again, looking for eye, but there was really no evidence there. And so I began the work here at Kerbet El Makadr after we finished over at Nisya. And then we've taken groups to Hatzor, for example, to work under the Israelis. But as far as having our own dig, it's been Nisya, Makadr, and then partnering with some other groups for other excavations.